Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back once again to New Books Network. Today, I'm here with Dr. Pankaj Jain to talk about his book, Dharma and Ecology of Hindu Communities, Sustenance and Sustainability. And I think coming to this book, before coming to the author himself, I think when I kind of came across this book, it was quite interesting in a sense for me also. I'm trying to look at the Hindu communities. I mean, even though my research work is on Christianity and animism and all, I'm also trying to understand the Hindu communities as such. So I think this is an opportunity for me also to kind of try to reflect on the Hindu communities and try to understand the very aspects of the Hindu community so that it will be a help for me in the days to come as I pursue my work also. So I think the work itself, in terms of trying to understand environment from the Hindu philosophical perspective and also religious perspective, is something which is quite interesting in that sense, because the book also talks about different communities and how, you know, we can use dharma and how, you know, this can be used as a way of trying to portray the Hindu way of trying to understand the environment, which might be a different way from how some other traditions might understand it. So I think that is a very interesting way of trying to put things and then also portray certain ideas of how the environment can be understood from a Hindu perspective. So I think let's just straight away go into the book itself. And before coming into the book, I think I would like the author to tell us something about yourself.
I'm here, if you see my background, I'm here at the Flame University in Pune area, just outskirts of Pune, where there is a Humanities, Department of Humanities and Languages, which I head. I'm the head of the department. I also chair the India Center, in which I've been running a series of webinars on covering various Indian assets, Indian facets, music and films and cultures, religions, languages, Ayurveda, yoga, and other different aspects of Indian civilization. Before joining Flame, I was in the US for 25 years. I got my MA and PhD in religious studies at University of Iowa and Columbia University. And then I was a tenure professor at the University of North Texas in Dallas area. And now I'm back in India, back in my motherland where I was born. Yes. Before going to US, I had BE Computer Science from Karnataka University. And I'm back in India.
Yeah, I think, you explained it in a very short way, but I think that's quite a journey, right? Long journey of going to different disciplines and, you know, now coming back to India. But that's quite interesting. So tell me something about this book, Dharma and Ecology of Hindu Communities. I mean, how did you come about developing an idea or kind of like what very influence of you coming towards writing a book, something like this, of Hindu understanding of the environment and such?
Yes. So when I was doing my PhD at the University of Iowa, I was looking for a topic which would have a contemporary relevance and also a topic that can, talk about the religious studies issues, different theoretical frameworks that we use in religious studies, and a topic that would cut across, you know, two different camps of liberal versus conservatives, or left versus right, blue versus red. You know, so I thought environmentalism would be a good topic to that cuts across party lines, that cuts across all these colors of greens and saffron and blue and red, right? So, and also I wanted to raise some theoretical issues. So the title of my dissertation and my book is Dharma and Ecology, not Religion and Ecology, which is one of the key terms or, you know, one of the disciplines in religious studies, but very consciously I chose to title my work as Dharma and Ecology, because Dharma is what defines many aspects of Indian culture, not religion, in my humble view. And many other people, many other senior scholars have also raised these issues. Asad Talal, right, and Bal Gangadhar in Belgium, and many other scholars have raised this issue that religion as such is does more injustice to non-Western world, such as in India, rather than that term or that notion of religion should be avoided when we study or write about non-Western cultures such as in India. So that all those issues I raise in my work.
Yeah, and that's quite an interesting trajectory of coming to work on a topic like this. And so coming to the contents of the chapter itself, and there are 8 chapters, including the introduction and conclusion. And coming to the preliminary aspects of trying to understand the aspect of dharma and the Hindu understanding of ecology or environment as such. So coming to the chapter 2, I mean, where you lay some theoretical framework. So what are some of the theoretical propositions that are there that when you were working on it, right, that were running around? And, you know, what were some of the theoretical propositions that you found was helpful, and also some of the positions that you found were not very helpful in trying to understand your work as such? Yeah.
Right. So before I started working on my research, I was aware of the contempt, you know, I had to do literature review, systematical literature review of the existing literature. And I found an edited volume by Lance Nelson in which he has raised issues that because Hinduism and even Jainism, Buddhism have these renunciatory impetus in their philosophy, in their theology, that world is just an illusion. So if world is an illusion, then nature is also illusion. Nature does not value. Nature is devalued in Hindu thought, Buddhist thought, and Jain thought because of the renunciation aspects. If that is the case, and if world is just an illusion, then nature, if nature is really getting degraded and nature's environment is getting polluted, Hindus, Buddhists, Jains would not care at all. And they wouldn't care, and they shouldn't care because nature is just an illusion. So that was the one major challenge to the any possibility of Hindu view towards ecology. That was already a major challenge by people like scholars like Lance Nelson in California. That was one major thing that I responded in my writing. And other models were what is called as devotional model, in which the devotional aspects of Hindu tradition are highlighted, such as that Earth is a goddess, mother goddess. So Hindus, because they are devoted towards Mother Earth, Mother Nature, cow, and many other stones and reptiles and animals and birds, saving or revering nature is part of being Hindu. So that devotional aspect can be very helpful in raising environmental awareness among Hindus. Other aspect or other model of environmentalism coming from India was what is called as renunciatory model, in which because of the renunciation zeal in Hinduism, Buddhism, Jainism, instead of, different from Lance Nelson, other scholars such as Chris Chappell have propounded that because of renunciation, the idea of possession, idea of consumption is much less in Hindu, Buddhist, and Jain tradition, because already the idea is to renounce everything. So if everything is to be renounced, then the idea of consumption or accumulation of resources would be much less and less and less. In my view, I think that would really apply to Jain and Buddhist views, because they really highlight renunciation much more than Hindu tradition, because Hindu tradition celebrates grihasthashram, the householder part of the life, in which you don't have to renounce prematurely. Until 75, you can live with family and you are supposed to be living in the society, but not of society. You don't have to become worldly, but you can still remain part of the world. So that is the Hindu view. So Hindu view or Hindu philosophy should be differentiated from Jain or Buddhist philosophy. That was, in my view, that was necessary, and that's what I differentiate. You know, don't have to club everything. Don't have to interpret Hindu tradition, which highlights or celebrates grihasthashram or householder life, that is the main impetus in Hindu tradition, not the sannyasa ashram, which is the main focus in Jain and Buddhist tradition. So those are the two models, devotional model and renunciation model, to try to understand these environmental aspects within Hindu and Indian culture at large. And then there was the challenge by Lance Nelson that needed to be responded. So that all is in that second chapter.
I've also heard a lot about, you know, this view of looking at the reality as something which is illusion, right? So illusion. That's why I'm saying that, you know, Hindu communities and all do not care about environment and all. So where does this idea comes from? And, you know, how does it connect to Hinduism, or where does it diverge in that sense? Yeah.
The idea of illusion, are you asking?
Yeah. The idea of illusion, yeah.
Okay. That is, I think, most famous statement about illusion comes from Adi Shankaracharya, almost 1,000 years from present time. He was a major philosopher, theologian, you know, whatever word we can use. But he was born in Kerala, and he defeated in intellectual debates Buddhist and Jain theologians and philosophers. And at least the legend is that he traveled across India and established four major centers to propagate Hindu philosophy, Hindu ideas, from Dwarka in the west, Puri in the east, in Odisha, present-day Odisha, and Badrinath, near Badrinath Joshimath in Uttarakhand, and in Sringeri in Karnataka area. There are the four mutts that were established. So the idea is that even though he did all this work, and he traveled across India, he did his best to propagate Hindu philosophy, intellectually defeated Buddhist and Jain philosophers. Yet there is a stereotype about Adi Shankaracharya that because he made this statement that Brahma Satyam Jagat Mithya, that only the Brahma, that is transcendental reality, only that is reality, only that is the true reality. Jagat Mithya means the world is illusion. That was one statement that we find in his writings. But I think to be really fair to Shankaracharya, we have to look at his work, and especially how Hindus have interpreted his life in general. Because from Hindu perspective, Shankara was not just a renunciatory person. He was not just a sannyasi. He was not just a monk who was sitting in some cave in Himalaya, but he was traveling across India. He made a great contribution to really revive Hindu philosophy, Hindu way of life in a major way. And because of his efforts, at least partly, Buddhism had to eventually, you know, a weakening of Buddhism definitely was fueled by the efforts or activism by Adi Shankaracharya. That's the Hindu view of the history of that time. So that's all that.
No, that's illusion. That's really quite interesting, because I come from a Christian tradition, and you know, when in Christian tradition, in the layman terms, when you talk about the Hindu communities in terms of how they understand reality, that then they say that okay, you know, it's an illusion, something like that, right? They understand reality as an illusion and all, and I mean that's what the, you know, in the normal conversation and all goes around, and I think the way you have spelled it out, of how, where, from where it has come from and how people have interpreted it, I think that really clarifies this very notion of trying to understand a reality in a very different way and from a very different lens. So I think that's quite very helpful. So here in the book, most importantly, you talk about a movement, a community, and also you talk about the fields. Fields. So these are some three important aspects that you kind of try to delve in and talk about. So coming to the first one, and I think, I don't know if I'm pronouncing this one right, but Swat Yaya movement. So coming to this movement. So what really is this Swat Yaya movement? So first of all.
Swadhyaya literally means simply self-study.
Okay.
And the movement started around 1940s when the founder, Dadaji Pandurang Shastri Athavale, he started giving discourses, pravachans in Mumbai area, CP tank area. There's a Bhagavad Gita Pathshala where he started giving pravachans, discourses, lectures on the Bhagavad Gita, Vedas, Upanishads, and so on. And as people started gathering and started listening to him, they were eventually inspired to put those ideas, put those teachings in their action, in their lives. So people started visiting remote areas of Gujarat, Saurashtra area, coastal areas of Gujarat, where they tried to share these ideas with their fellow Hindus in coastal areas of Gujarat. And eventually, those kind of visits, which were called as Bhakti Feri, in Bhavapuri, that is devotional visits, led to the creation of a new kind of a community was called as Swadhyay Parivar. And in that, the idea was that we are all united by common bond of spirituality. So that Parivar feeling, Vasudhaiva Kutumbakam, which is also in the Hindu text, that entire world is a, entire planet is a family, entire world is a family. So how do we experience that, that family feeling or universal brotherhood or sisterhood, universal fraternity, how to experience that? So that this is an experiment, as they call these actions, these bhakti ferries, kind of an experiment, spiritual experiment. So in that, spirit of experiment, as they met their fellow Hindus in Gujarat and eventually Madhya Pradesh, Maharashtra, and different parts of India, and eventually different parts of the world. You know, almost every part of the world has Swadhyay movement now. So idea was to keep expanding and keep experiencing this idea of a universal brother, universal fraternity. So that is how the work started. It became a family, spiritual family. And then with the family, you know, everything that was done by these people had some byproducts as environmentalism. Environmentalism as such was not their official focus. Their focus was simply to keep experiencing this spiritual brotherhood, fraternity. And so whatever else happened in the society or in the environment was just a byproduct. That was not the focus. So they did many, many things. They created new orchards, new gardens, new sacred groves, and so on. So all that had very positive environmental impact.
You talk about different features of Swadhyay movement that resembles different world traditions, different features. Now, just give a short description of all these features. The first feature was the arboreal dharma, and the second was bovine dharma, earth dharma. And then I think lastly, you talk about this yogesvara. Give a short description about what all of this dharma is about.
Right. So arboreal dharma I coined this term. What they call is Vriksh Mandir simply. Vriksh Mandir. Vriksh means tree. Mandir means temple. So tree temples. So they created more than 24 tree temples in different districts of Gujarat, where the entire village would come together, buy a piece of land, plant some fruit trees, and whatever income comes out of those fruits is sold in the market. And whatever money comes is treated as a divine blessing from divinity. And that money is used very consciously, very carefully to help needy people in their particular local village. So that was an example of arboreal dharma. Arboreal means, botanical dharma, kind of. Then there is Yogeshwar Krishi, which is spiritual farming. And the idea is, again, similar, whatever grain you're raising, growing, paddy or whatever, wheat or whatever. And again, the whatever profit comes out of that farming is again treated like a spiritual blessing. That's how the entire village gets benefit. And similarly, cattle or goras or cattle worship, in which whatever dairy products are sold are the spiritual property of the entire village. So these are the examples. So then ocean worship is another example, Samudra Puja, ocean worship, and on and on. So they created these experiments. They don't call it project or, they are not charity work, but they are all, again, to express their gratitude, their, experience the divinity, experience the reverence for trees, reverence for cattle, reverence for ocean, reverence for Mother Earth, reverence for Mother Nature. In that effort to express their reverence for nature, if a byproduct, like a byproduct, if the trees are being planted or farming is done in a more better way, or cattle are being treated in a better way, these are all just byproducts. They are, helpful for the environment, but that's not the real focus of their work. That's what they always clarified, that we are not environmentalists, we are simply devotees of Krishna, devotees of maybe, different Hindu gods and goddesses, but they're not environmentalists. That's what their emphasis was always, and is always still.
So that is the description of all this arboreal, bovine, and the art term, right? That is how it is portrayed. Yeah, and that's really interesting. And so coming to the fourth chapter, I think this is where you talk about the Bishnoi community. So who are these Bishnois, and what is this community? Yeah.
Right. So Bishnoi people came into the news first time. They caught attention of many people in India that time in the 90s when there was a Hindi film being made in, the shooting was happening in Rajasthan, my home state, by the way. and not too far from where I was born. This film was being shot in Jodhpur, Pali region. And Salman Khan, Saif Ali Khan, Tabu, and Neelam, these actors and actresses in the film, actors and actors, they were, you know, involved in shooting, film shooting. In one of the breaks, I guess, shooting breaks, they wanted to have some leisure activities, entertainment, whatever they were trying to do. So they rushed to a Bishnoi village. They went to a Bishnoi village called Kankani area, where Bishnoi people live. And that's where black bucks can also be found, because Bishnois have made sure that no hunters or poachers were ever allowed to hunt these animals, or even green trees were not allowed to cut by any outsiders in the Bishnoi villages. So Salman Khan and his colleagues, his friends, when they come and when they go to this village and when Salman shoot a black buck, so Bishnoi people rush to the spot. Salman is caught, given to the police, and the court case has been running for, you know, many decades now. So that's when Bishnois first came into the picture. But very little was known, especially in English language, of Bishnoi culture, Bishnoi history, Bishnoi rituals, who these Bishnois are, what's the meaning of the word Bishnoi. So all that I traced, being you know, native of that region, I could connect with Bishnoi people very easily. I could understand their language, Rajasthani. So I translated their entire sacred text from Rajasthani Hindi to English. I collected all the ritual details. I added all the ritual details also in my book. All the different examples of their environmentalism. Salman Khan is just, you know, tip of the iceberg. They have been doing these things. They've been stopping hunters and poachers. They've been catching hunters and poachers for decades, even centuries. So they have a long history of 500 years. And the Swadhyay Parivar is almost one century. But Bishnoi people have their history of 5 centuries. And so I go all the way to the origin of Bishnois, how they started. What's the meaning of the word Bishnoi? Bishnoi means 20 and 9. They have 29 rules by which they live their entire life. The Guru Jambeshwar, their founder, was born also in the desert region of Rajasthan. And when there was no rain for many years, he has some kind of a mystical experience. And he comes out with these 29 rules in which he asks his followers to make sure that no green tree is cut, no meat is consumed by Bishnois. So vegetarianism was highly promoted 500 years back by the Bishnoi founder, Guru Jambeshwar. Daily hygiene was to be practiced. Daily shower has to be taken by all Bishnois. So all those very interesting rules he formulated, that became the foundation for Bishnoi dharma, Bishnoi culture, Bishnoi community. So I go to the different villages. I went to different villages of Rajasthan, and I traced their history and their environmentalism, their culture, their rituals. So all that becomes part of the chapter on Bishnois.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Well, yeah. And I think in this chapter, you brought out the aspect of dharmic environmentalism among the Bishnois in the history, and also about dharmic sanctuaries. You know, you brought out these two aspects. So what are some of the interesting features in that sense, in this aspect, right? In these two aspects, coming to the Bishnois, when you look at the Bishnois, what are some of the interesting features of these aspects? Yeah.
So like I mentioned that, you know, long before climate change or biodiversity, global warming, environmentalism, long before these words that entered our language, our daily usage, you know, 500 years before, Guru Jambeshwar had already tried his best to take care of the very fragile ecology of Rajasthan, which is the desert region. So now, even today, we find Rajasthan desert, or India's the only state of India where there is some desert is Rajasthan. But Rajasthan remains the most densely populated desert in the world in terms of flora and fauna and humans. So why this flourishing of flora and fauna, you know, humans and animals and birds and plants and trees that are found in this desert region? One of the reasons is the Bishnoi community, because they have practiced strict vegetarianism. They have not allowed anybody to cut their green trees. Nobody can go and kill their black bucks or deer or any other animals or birds. Their founder taught these great lessons to his followers. And he also did many of the things that he was teaching others. So he created also these new sacred groves that are still maintained by Bishnoi people. World's first environmental sacrifice was also done by Bishnoi in 1730s or so. About 363 Bishnoi men, women, and children sacrificed their lives as they literally hugged their Khejdi tree near Pali and Jodhpur in Rajasthan region. And as Bishnoi, as the soldiers from Jodhpur king were looking for the green, you know, firewood, you know, from the Bishnoi villages, Bishnoi people sacrificed their lives, but they did not let the green trees cut by these soldiers. So that's the first major example of environmental sacrifice, literal sacrifice to save trees that we find in Bishnoi village. Many scholars think that example of literal hugging of the trees became the role model or became the inspiration for the Chipko movement in 1970s when people in Uttarakhand, people in Himalayan villages of present-day Uttarakhand or that time Uttar Pradesh, when they also literally hugged the trees and saved thousands of trees in the entire Himalayan region. So those are some really interesting aspects of Bishnoi that now they are pretty well known. But when I was doing my research, my translation of their work is the first translation in English of the Bishnoi sacred text and Bishnoi history, Bishnoi culture and environmentalism.
So coming to the next chapter, I mean, you have been saying this word, sacred groves. So, for the sake of our audience, what is this sacred groove? What makes a groove sacred? Yeah,
Tia, you are sitting in Meghalaya. And when I came to Meghalaya in 2018, I went to Nehu, where you are located, where you're doing your PhD. Then I went to Shillong, I went to Cherrapunji. Mm-hmm. Just on the outskirts of Shillong, there is a major sacred grove, which is maintained by local tribes. And all it means is nothing can be cut, not even a leaf can be taken out of that sacred grove. Sacred means reverential, revered. Grove means bunch of trees or, you know, group or a part of a forest. So any part of the forest where not a single leaf, not a single piece of that tree, any tree can be taken out, that is called sacred, because the entire patch of that forest is sacred for the local communities. There are thousands and thousands of sacred groves across India and other parts of the world as well, but especially where more tribal people are, because tribal people or local indigenous people have very close connection with nature across India and across the world. Native Americans in North America, South America, in Africa, and Southeast Asia, and definitely in India. So sacred groves were newly created by Swadhyay Parivar, like I mentioned earlier, Bishnoi people by Guru Jambeshwar, and by Bhil community, which is my next chapter. The Bhils still have their sacred groves where not a single leaf, not a single twig can be taken out of that sacred grove in Rajasthan, Gujarat, Madhya Pradesh, where I did my research for my third chapter. So that is the sacred grove. So that is how you explain sacred grove, where there is a shrine inside that patch of the forest. Because of the shrine, because of the deity, the entire patch becomes sacred, very, very, very sacred, extremely sacred.
Yeah. And while talking about sacred groves, you specifically pick up this Bhil community. So who are these Bhils?
Right. So like I was just hinting, so indigenous people of any region are also called as, you know, in common language, tribal people. So Bhil is one of the scheduled tribes of India, like Meenas and other many others, indigenous communities. So Bhils are also one of the scheduled tribes of India. And so because they have been living on their land for thousands of years, so that is how they have lived. So, you know, they have also designated some part of the forest as sacred grove, because inside that sacred grove, there is a small shrine to Hanuman, to local Bhairav or local Shiva or any, you know, any stone like a figure. And they just start doing rituals on that figure and becomes a, you know, temple, a small shrine And because of the shrine, that part of the forest becomes sacred, and that sacred area of that forest is saved. And as the nearby areas of trees, nearby tree can be cut, but because of the sacred grove, that tree will not, those trees will not, never be cut. That is how they have saved their flora and fauna for thousands of years.
Yeah.
So that is how fields have done.
Yeah. So and when you talk about the fields, interestingly, you use the word like faith-based sacred groups. And also the second category is faith-based and government effort sacred group related to. So what are these distinctions and what is this faith-based sacred groups?
Yeah, so sacred groves or any plantation activities, if they are done by the government, it has a very limited appeal. You know, government people will come, forest department, they will come and they will plant some new trees. But if nobody is maintaining those trees may not survive after a few years. But if the trees are planted and taken care of with faith as their main emphasis, because people have faith in certain indigenous local trees, then those trees have really long life. Those trees will survive forever. So even government departments such as forest departments in India, they, in many cases, they will work in tandem with local communities, indigenous communities, so that the trees can be better taken care of. Trees will not die off after a few years. So that is how they both work hand in hand. That is how they've made sure that the trees survive, forests survive for, whatever, with such a heavy pressure of population in India, there are almost 1.4 billion people in India. And yet only in India, outside Africa, only in India, you find large beasts such as rhinoceros in Assam, not too far from where you are, Aditya. We find elephants, large elephants all across India. We find lions only in Gujarat, in India, outside Africa. Only other country, no other country in the world has lions except India and Africa. Of course, African countries have lions, but African countries are not so heavily populated. But India has 1.4 billion people. If there is any other comparative country, all animals are wiped out. North America, no wildlife, no major beasts are found in North America, South America, or China, Russia, all everywhere, they're all extinct, they're all gone. They're all killed, hunted for whatever reasons, for the different parts of animals, smuggling, whatever. But in India, we have tigers, we have leopards, we have rhinoceros, we have elephants, we have bears, we have lions. So why? Because of these communities that have taken care, that treat these animals, many of these animals, many of these trees are treated sacred, treated as if they are divine. Because of the traditions of vegetarianism. That is how these forests have survived for thousands of years, and even today they survive. And many of the cases are where national park is designated by Indian government or state governments, but they work hand in hand with local communities. Because if you don't involve local communities, those government efforts are all top-down efforts, but local communities are bottom-up of effort. They have been living there for thousands of years. So when both forces combine together, join together, that is how you save the flora and fauna. That is how you save beasts. That is how you save animals and forests. And that is how India still does have all these large parts of forests that are still intact across Arunachal Pradesh, across Assam, across Himalayas, across many parts of Gujarat and South India. And on and on.
Yeah. So since we have talked so much about the communities and the people and how they understand the environment and the dharma and all, during the last part of your chapterization, chapter 7, we come to some theoretical aspect. And I think let's just dabble on some theoretical aspect because these are some things which are very important. So how do we understand the word dharma? Can you explain something or say something on this? Yeah.
Right. So in the beginning, I was alluding to the word dharma, which is a better word for understanding Indian culture, non-Western cultures. Because especially in the Indian context, dharma comes from the Sanskrit root dhri. Dhri means to sustain, to withhold, to support. Right. And dhri means to sustain, most importantly. And sustain is the root for the word sustainability and sustenance. Right. So I connect sustainability with the meaning of the word dharma, which is based on the root dhri. Dhri also means to sustain. So dharma inherently, implicitly means to sustain. Dharma is the force that sustains the universe, that sustains the entire human society, the animal kingdom, the entire planet, the entire cosmos, entire, all the universal forces, seasons, everything is sustained by, in the Vedas, there was a word called Ritam. Ritam, which means, which is translated, which can be translated as cosmic rhythm. So Ritam maintains the cosmic rhythm. And then eventually Ritam was replaced by Dharma in the Rigveda itself. Dharma has the same connotations of the cosmic rhythm. Dharma is also, as I explained, Dharma has this root of the word sustain, to sustain. Mm-hmm. So Dharma is the idea that all these communities are based on. Vishnu is, Swadhyay is, and Bhils. And the way they treat their flora and fauna is not as environmentalist. They're just, expressing their life. Their life principles are around these ideas of treating everything as sacred, not harming others, yeah, and following the rules of nature. Based on these dharmic cosmic rhythms, their flora and fauna are sustained for thousands of years. That is what I show in my book.
Yeah, and so you talk about the distinction between dharma and religion. And so how do you distinguish this?
Right, so religion word comes with the root of religio, which comes from Abrahamic notions of having a sacred scripture, a prophet or a messiah, and trying to organize a community around a scripture or around a prophet or a messiah. Non-Western cultures are not necessarily based on those notions. There is no founder. There is no one scripture. There is no one messiah or prophet. So the idea is not to organize the community around, on one particular day, such as Sunday or Friday. But the idea is to live according to the principles of nature, to live by treating every particle of the universe as divine. That is the idea of Buddhism. When Buddhism talks about jewel net of Indra, which means the entire cosmos is a jewel net of Indra. Every particle is a reflection of all the other infinite particles of the universe. So every particle has this reflection of the Buddhahood, of Buddha nature, which means every particle becomes divine in jewel net of Indra in Buddhism. Similarly, in Hinduism, Brahman pervades every particle of the universe. So everything becomes divine. Every being becomes divine in Hinduism. Similarly, in Jainism, because everything has soul. Even air, fire, earth, and water has soul in Jainism. So every being has the right to survive, to flourish, not just survive, not just to sustain, but to thrive. Every being has inherent right, and privilege, and duty to survive and thrive and flourish in all these three traditions, because all three are based on the dharmic ideas of universality of spirituality, universality of Atman, Brahman, Buddhahood. That is the idea of Brahman, where there is no separation between God and humans or nature, animals or humans, nature or culture. All those boundaries and barriers automatically dissolve when the ideas of universality of Dharma, Brahman, Buddha, and Atma are applied in Buddhism, Hinduism, Jainism. That is the idea. That is how Dharma is different from the idea of religion.
And when talking about the environment, you have also often taken the example of Christianity, in that sense of how, in terms of Christianity, how their idea of trying to understand the environment have also developed. So coming to the idea of Dharma and trying to understand the environment from the perspective of Dharma for Hindu communities, what do you think is the difference between how Christians try to understand it and how the Dharmic view try to understand the environment?
Right. Christianity also has a great example of Saint Nicholas of Pusa. Saint Nicholas, who was also, was able to talk to animals and birds. And so there are some, exceptional examples even in Christianity where some saints have talked to animals and birds and very animal friendly. And in recent times, Christianity is also being, there is a major focus, especially in the U.S. And even the Pope, the current Pope in Rome has given these new guidelines of even a new environmental destruction is also one of the sins, according to the Pope in Catholicism. So Christianity is also trying to reinterpret itself and trying to become more and more environmental friendly. And even, many churches have, given these new guidelines to take care of the environment. And something which is, we find more and more in common with what has been already happening in Hindu texts for thousands of years. In Ramayana and Mahabharata, entire episodes, entire text is woven around forests. Main heroes, main protagonists, Pandavas and Ram and Lakshman and Sita, they're always roaming around in the forests. Entire life is woven around the forests. So that is how we, you know, in Veda, many, many rituals are around trees, stones, animals, birds in Hinduism, Buddhism, and Jainism, of course, because of nonviolence, also treats every particle as, you know, very, very carefully and very respectfully. So those things are also happening now in Christianity as the reinterpretation is going on, as the, they call it constructive theology. So they are trying to reconstruct theology in the new light of environmentalism. So that is how it is also happening in Christianity now.
Yeah. That's quite interesting. I see, since you have gone through interviewing these people and you have seen the ground reality of how this dharmic understanding of the environment is practiced, and you know, you have really thought about these aspects. So coming to the modern life is when the structure, the big structures like building and then the kind of like machinery and all of these industries are necessary, right? How does these two go hand in hand, the dharmic understanding of environment and how does the advancement in technology and all those things, how can these two go hand in hand in terms of the development in industries and all?
Yeah, now it's a big challenge because all these great ideas that Gandhi also exemplified. Gandhi didn't want modern, big industries, and he was all, more in support of local communities, such as what I describe also, Bishnois, Swadhyays, and Bhils. They are all rural communities. They are not, urban communities. But with big cities and big industries, it is going to be a challenge now. It's already, effects of climate change, we can already experience, all these big floods in every part of the world now, Germany or Spain or Italy or United States or India. No part of the world is now untouched by climate change impact. So it's a bit too late now for us to, think of dharmic ideas, because these communities have been doing these things for thousands of years in the case of Bhil community, hundreds of years in the case of Bishnoi community, and many decades now by Swadhyayi. But these are all now, small kind of role models. If we listen to these communities, if we listen to Gandhi, we could have avoided climate change impact. Now all we can do is mitigate the effects of climate change. We have to really save the society, whatever society is left now, we have to just try to save it now. So we have to now really accelerate and, go for more green technologies. Even that may be too late, because, no technology there is no technology that does not have a carbon footprint. Even electric cars are made with, great amount of carbon, greenhouse gas emission that are emitted into the atmosphere. There is no, there is no sacred, there is no magic bullet now. Unfortunately, we are hit now for avoiding climate change.
And I think all of us together as humanity, we need to work towards, trying to better understand also Edison and mitigate these effects. So I think that's something which is very important. So in our conversation, is there anything that I've missed out which you think is important and needs to be spelled out? Yeah.
No, I think we covered pretty much all the major aspects. That's my first book. Yes.
Yeah. So the norm is that I ask you what is your next project, but then, we are coming together again for another book of yours. So give a kind of a teaser for our next podcast interview about your next book. Yeah.
It's called as Moving the Mountains, okay. Science and Social Religious Revolution in India, and that is based on my research in Uttarakhand and Punjab. So we'll talk about that maybe in the second episode.
Yeah, I think that'll be very exciting. We'll be talking about the scientific aspect, right?
Yes.
So sure, yeah, sure. that will be very interesting. So I think I'm also eagerly waiting for the next podcast, because let me say something about this podcast itself and for the listeners also. Since for me, since my research work and my tradition has been from Christianity, and my research work now, I'm into trying to understand Christianity and animism in the Northeast, the place I'm from and all. And I haven't really gone much into the Hindu communities and their texts and all. So I think for me, I think the conversation here is a very good learning. It has been a really good learning experience in that sense, because at least I'm talking with someone who has really gone into texts and who have understood the communities and, brings example from the firsthand research work. So I think It's a very good starting point for also for any listeners to really pick up the book and also kind of, you know, where this conversation and the book can go hand in hand in trying to understand the conceptual aspects and also trying to understand the human communities and how the dharma works and how it can really help in trying to mitigate the environmental crisis that we are also facing. So I think it has been a very lovely conversation. Thank you, Dr. Pankaj, for being here with me.
Thank you, Tia.